welcome you to another edition of the program Currenti, a program that debates an array of current affairs issues. Today I will be conducting this program in English because my guest is English-speaking, not only, but she's also English-speaking. In fact, my guest is Miss Rachel Feinmesser, who is the head of the press office of the Israeli embassy in Italy, that also services and provides services to Malta. Ms. Feinmesser has quite an interesting CV. She's been involved in diplomatic duties in Jerusalem, in Guatemala, all the nice places, in Philadelphia, in the USA, in North America, and has been since 2004 in the press office in the Italian in the Israeli embassy in Rome. And I would like to welcome you, and I would like to welcome you not only to Campus FM but also to the University of Malta. I hope that we have other opportunities where we can keep working together. Well, I've said a bit about you, but you're if you could give us a bit of a profile so that people get to know Rachel.
First, thank you for the invitation. It is a pleasure. I was born in Israel. My parents were born in Israel. I was born actually in a kibbutz, which is a very unique way of life. It's a community based on communist ideas. The Zionist movement was based on socialist ideas. I mean, it was a combination of socialism and nationalism, and we'll talk about it maybe later. And they formed this very particular way of life in Israel, which we call kibbutz. It's a community of people, a few hundred. It began in very small groups, but today it's a few hundred or a few thousand people who share all their property. I mean, they do not had in the past, today it's changing, any personal belongings. Oh. And the motto was everybody contribute as he can, gets what it needs. I mean, the communist
idea. You were brought up, do I get right that the kibbutz where children used to sleep in the same?
So, yeah, we slept, I mean, we grew up as a group of kids. We studied together. We went to our parents' little houses, very small houses, for a few hours in the afternoon. And we were brought back in the evening, and we slept together with the other kids.
Wasn't it traumatic?
Not for me. I think it was for some kids. I mean, clearly it's not the natural way, right, that kids grew up with their families. I mean, we did. The family connection was very, very strong. I mean, but this idea that kids are growing in a shared community and they live their full life, really, with another group of kids that are not necessarily their brothers and sisters is clearly a very unique way of living. Okay. These days in Israel, there are many artists who grew up in a kibbutz and talk about it in different ways. There were some movies made, some of them very critical about this way of life. Some are much more understanding in a way in that that those ideas. I think the unique thing about the kibbutz, if you think about communism in Russia, for instance, that was imposed on the people. And maybe because of that, because of many, many reasons, but as well because of that collapse in the end, because there was no will of the people to have this kind of life. The difference in the kibbutzim in Israel, that it was a personal choice.
So your parents could choose to move out.
Exactly. But choose to participate in that.
But would the community have looked down upon the your parents? I don't know what the surname of your parents is. The fine misers, let's say. The community would look down on them or recognize them as failing the kibbutz if they
Who left, you mean?
Yeah, I mean people who stay towards people who left. They're seeing people leave. those are, you know, they have failed us because they have...
Well, I'm not sure looking down, but clearly there was a sense of disappointment at the beginning. I'm talking in the 40s and the 50s. You know, the kibbutzim began at the beginning of the century of the 20th centuries.
And I need to make it clear here that you weren't there in those days.
No. So, I was born in the 60s. But in the 40s and 50s, the first kids of the kibbutz who left, right, who went to the city, who decided this is not the way of life, there was a sense of disappointment of the community, you know, what did we do wrong? I mean, but it was a completely liberal in that respect. I mean, there was no obstacle. Whomever want to leave, left. It was a completely free society. So, you know.
Yeah. So you used to drive tractors in the fields and...
Yes, it was a community.
An agrarian base.
Yeah, it was based in the beginning. It was agrarian, and with the years it changed, and many kibbutzim have industry as well. You know, different kind of industry. Today there's a lot of tourism. I mean, hotels. Yeah. Many have today high tech industries. Yeah. You know, it changed a lot. Just to give you an example, in the beginning, in the 50s, in the 60s, if you wanted to go to the university, since the kibbutz paid for your university, they had to, the community had to approve what you wanted to study. If you wanted to study engineering, they could tell you, no, we are lacking of teachers, and you'll go to study education.
So you come back to the kibbutz and offer the service. So the idea was that once there, you're always there.
If you didn't like that, you could always leave, but then you had to pay for your own tuition. I mean, of course, there was always a possibility, you know. People have to understand it wasn't a jail. I mean, it was a very, very free community. Nobody owned a car. I remember when we received our first TV, and I was, you know, I wasn't a baby. It was in the 70s when the kibbutz bought for all the members of the kibbutz, the first TV sets. I mean, before that, we had one TV set that was in the, you know, in the gathering place. And we all watched together over there. So, of course, there's an evolution as the world changes, the kibbutzim are changing.
So there was a sort of a council or something of the sort. There was a group of people who managed the kibbutz?
No, it was, I mean, everything, every decision had to be voted in the General Assembly. I mean, all members had the right to vote. Oh, okay. Every week there was a General Assembly on the list of, you know, issues that should be decided. And every decision was made by all of the members.
Okay. And how big was the kibbutz? Or there wasn't any...
Well, just, I mean, to give you an example, the kibbutz where I was born, my grandparents, who were the pioneers, the first one, it was a group of 25 people, more or less.
Okay.
Today, the community is about 600 people, but with the kids, I mean, everybody, from the elderly to babies.
But you moved out.
Yeah, after my military service, I decided that this is not the right...
So you were a soldier as well?
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, like all Israelis.
Yes.
My mother still lives in the kibbutz. Two of my sisters have stayed in the kibbutz with their families, and actually already their children are coming back to live in the kibbutz, chose to live in the kibbutz.
If I go to Israel, I can ask for...
Absolutely.
And access the kibbutz with all the possibilities of meeting people. So it's a very
well, you have
community.
To know somebody. I mean, it's like entering somebody's home, right?
That's right. No, in that sense. Excellent. I mean, I didn't know about your experience with the kibbutz because I would have asked you to speak to my sociology students because it's one thing talking from books and one thing having the direct experience. Interesting. I'd like us to start off. I was going to say, but we've already said a lot. But I'd like you to give me a bit of a profile about to help us understand Israel. What is Israel? I mean, how would you describe this the land of Israel? I mean, the country, this nation. What are the characteristics, what are the features, what are the ingredients that make Israel?
I know we hear today more to speak about modern Israel,
that's
which
right.
I like very much. But I would like to give a very, very short historical perspective, since we talked before and we have a strong sense that the historical perspective is lacking tremendously in the media coverage mm-hmm. of Israel, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, of the Middle East in general. And as people know, I mean, from biblical studies or from studying the Bible, Jews have lived in Israel for millennium and were expelled from Israel with the after the Roman occupation of that phase, or the Roman Empire. There was always a Jewish settlements or cities in Israel, and that was Jerusalem, of course, in Tiberias, in Tzfat. And throughout centuries, Jews have continued to live in Israel. Parallel to that, and after the Muslim occupation of the Middle East and North Africa, of course, there was as well Muslim presence in that part of the world, as in the whole Middle East. At the end of the 19th century, as a revival of national ideas in Europe, and because of persecution of Jews throughout history, in Europe mainly, there was a revival of a national Jewish movement. Mm. The idea that Jews cannot live among other people. The Jews throughout the history were always, unfortunately, we have to say that, almost always considered as a minority who is a stranger to the general population, as a minority that is inferior. There were fears from the Jews, the sense of a Jew as a different man. And we experienced that almost in all of Europe. I mean, and I'm concentrating on Europe because those problems were mainly in Europe. Jews have lived in ghettos, were restricted from owning a house. Many jobs were forbidden for Jews in Europe. Jews could not own a land, a house for centuries in Europe, and not to mention persecution. And we can talk from the Crusaders, whom on the way to Jerusalem have killed thousands of Jews in Germany, for instance, in France, and here I'm talking about the 11th or 12th centuries and going onwards in history. In the 19th century, the revival of nationalism in Europe, in the Balkans, in Italy, brought those ideas to the Jewish communities. And the national Jewish movement, which we call Zionism, mm-hmm. Was born in Europe, and the first Jewish immigrants that arrived in Israel came in 1875, more or less. And from there onward, there was a constant flow of Jews from Europe, mainly from Europe, to the land of Israel. In the 40s, already under the British mandate, it was clear that there are two main population in this part of the Mediterranean, an Arab population and a Jewish population. And when the British mandate was about to end, and it wasn't clear how that situation could be resolved, the UN have decided to send a commission to Israel and to work out a solution. And the solution was as such that there will be two states in that land where the British mandate was, a Jewish state and an Arab state. And that resolution was passed in vast majority in the UN in 1947. When the British left Israel in May 48, the day after they left, the last British soldier have left that land, seven Arab armies have launched a war on the Jewish population in that land. Mm. We call it our war of independence. since the Arab lost in that war at the end, for the Arab who lived in that territory, this is a very traumatic experience. But I want to emphasize that the idea of two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state, was born in 47 and was voted in the UN and was accepted by the Jewish population in Israel and outside of Israel. And we could have saved many lives and many tragedies.
Why are you insisting on this, the fact that two states had been already...
Because I'll tell you why. If we now we are going 60 years ahead for today, and I want to point out that there are two tracks, parallel tracks. The first one is the track that brought the Arab world from 60 years ago to where we stand today. For almost 60 years, there was a total denial of the Arab world of the right of Israel to exist in the Middle East. It began long before 47, but the war was a major sign that the Arab world does not accept the notion that there will be a Jewish state in the Middle East. I mean, the resolution was rejected by the Arab world. The war was a complete denial of the right of Israel to exist, because it wasn't war about the borders. It was war against the notion that the Jews should have their own state in the land of their ancestors, you know, in the land of their historic land. And throughout the years, the denial continued. And we, even in the 1969, the resolution of Khartoum, no to Israel, no to peace. I mean, I'm talking about the Arab League, 22 Arab countries. And maybe the big change in the last 15, 20 years began with Egypt, with Anwar Sadat, who came to Jerusalem and who said, I'm here. I'm talking here in an Israeli parliament. I'm ready to sign a peace treaty with Israel, which means I, Egypt, the biggest country of the Middle East, recognize the right of Israel to exist, and now we have to talk about the borders. Now we have a border dispute, which is fine. And you know, there's so many borders disputes around the world. And then there was King Hussein of Jordan, who signed a peace treaty in Israel, and the same recognition. I recognize the right of Israel to exist. Now we have to fix the borders, and we'll live in peace with each other. Even with Syria, which clearly we do not have peace with, I mean, the idea of talks, the Syrian president who said a peace treaty for the Golan Heights, which is fine. 25 years ago, we didn't hear that. And now it's clear. I mean, we want to set our differences. We want assurances, maybe security for security problems that we have, but we have a border dispute. The same goes with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so let me go back a bit. All this. I don't know if I'm saying this right, but all this hatred that has been directed towards the Jews, it wasn't just since 48 or 40. There was always a history sort of thing that the Jews sort of almost attracted hatred. How do you explain this? Because it's not just about land, and about the land of Israel or about the state of Israel. It seems to be almost endemic, almost ongoing. This, you know, there's a fear of Jews. I mean, even in other countries. I mean, we have even idioms in Malta, sayings that give the idea that you need to be careful of a Jew. How come this?
You know, we have to separate between an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is a national conflict, you know, where two people wanted to live on the same land, and now the question is how to make a just deal that everybody will be happy. And that is different from anti-Semitism. And mm-hmm. the roots of anti-Semitism are as antique as, you know, as civilizations. And there are many explanations. Clearly, it all began from religious reasons. I mean, first there was a legend that the Jews killed Jesus. Okay. And even if historically, clearly, it wasn't the truth, but that was for many, many years what was Christians have heard in the churches. A combination to that was that Jews did not want to convert. I mean, Christianity, I mean, aim at converting everybody else. And the Jews were had a very strong identity. And throughout history, we hear of stories of leaders, king, monarchs, the church, who wanted to convert the Jews, and the Jews did not agree to that. So either they were tortured to death, or they were expelled, or they had to convert and inside their house to keep practicing their own traditions. Mm-hmm. I think those the fear of a different, you know, you always suspect that whomever is different from you is maybe evil, mm-hmm. is maybe have a conspiracy kind of issues. The fears came out of maybe of the fact that the Jewish tradition, and this was very different from Christians in many during the history. The Jewish tradition, I mean, we all have to be able to read by ourselves the Bible. Mm-hmm. So Jewish kids are starting from the age of 3 or 4 to read and write. Whereas in Christianity, for many, many years, it was the priest who explained the religion to the people. I mean, and that was his strength, right? Mm-hmm. That only him can, mm-hmm. He can read in the Testament, the New Testament. So all those differences created this antagonism or hate, as you say, towards the Jews. And I think the root of that is a fear of the different. I mean, whomever is different from you. And if I had to point out of a major issue, so the combination of the church and this very antique hatred towards the Jews because of that claim, right, that they are responsible for the murder of Jesus. And that fear that is very, very human, very, very natural of somebody who's different from you, and we could see it still today. I mean, people are afraid from immigrants. People are afraid from other religions mm-hmm. sometimes, and this is true. I mean, on a combination to that, and here stories were built. We were talking about that before. Jews could not own land. Could not. They were deprived of many, many rights. So what they could do, they were merchants. Because, I mean, to bring merchandise from one place to another and to sell it, they were always involved in banking system because they were allowed to, I mean, because they were not allowed to do other things. Yeah. So here the story begins about Jews with money, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And about Jews who are in the loaning business just because the church did not allow Christians to do that. And deprive Jews of other rights. And here you have a very problematic combination. But anti-Semitism clearly is an issue for serious of radio programs. I have to emphasize though that this is really, I mean, was very, very strong in Europe, whereas Jews have lived in Northern Africa. And for many years, did not suffer from any persecution, I'm sorry, or this kind of hatred. I mean, the relationship between Muslim and Jews, for example, Northern Africa is a very good example. And I'm talking here from Egypt to Morocco, have lived together for centuries. And these phenomena that were very, very strong in Europe, were not there. So, you know, we have to divide. Anti-Semitism is one thing, and the conflict between Israel and the Arab world and today Israel and the Palestinian is another issue. It's created another set of hard feelings, of hate, right? But I want to distinguish between the two.
Can I be a bit hard on you?
Yes, of course.
but I keep getting the impression that it's always their fault. It's never the Jewish fault. I mean, I get the impression that Jews were always the victims in everything. And
well, historically they were. Unfortunately, I'll have to tell you, you know, if you look
about
everywhere,
settlements, for example,
about
if you talk about settlements and about creating fences and about
we're talking about Israel now, not about the history in Europe.
Well, we can talk about let's put that to the side, but. Well, all right, if we had to talk about
Europe, maybe just to close the story about anti-Semitism in Europe. Here, Jews were the victims, always, throughout history. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an example, from the families of my four grandfathers, grandparents, in Poland and Germany, each of them had from 6 to 8 brothers and sisters, all of them. So you combine all of them together, we're talking about more or less 25 cousins. I mean, the whole. They survived, the four of them, who immigrated to Israel long before the Holocaust. And I have two aunts. The rest were murdered in the camps in Germany and mainly in Poland. Poland. I mean, there were 3 million Jews in Poland. Mm-hmm. 3 million Jews. Today you have a community of maybe 200 people. So, I mean, if somebody think the Jews were not the victim, he have to read some material. Jews were victims for persecution for two thousands of years, let's say, but clearly during the Second World War, and 6 million Jews were murdered in Europe. I mean, that happened only 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all, 65 years ago. We should all remember that. Mm-hmm. And most Europeans looked the other way and did not want to hear what's happening.
At the time.
At the time, of course. Of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about Malta, which was completely out of that scene, but I'm talking about people in Germany, in Poland, in France, in Italy. Mm-hmm. In Italy. The Jewish community in Italy, in Rome, is the most ancient Jewish communities. Jews were brought as slaves by the Roman. Jews are living in Rome for 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. And they were one night gathered in the ghetto, in the center of Rome, to whom knows Rome, mm-hmm. in the center of Rome, they were gathered and sent to the gas chambers. I mean, they were sent by trains to Poland. It was and were
just one night.
And they did not come back. From 2,000, over 2,000, 70 people came back. So, I mean, about the Jewish history in Europe, I think it's important that young people will study and will remember what happened in this continent only 65 years ago.
I mean, but is it? I understand very, very much your point, even though I may not feel it the way you feel, because obviously I was not there. I'm not a Jew, so obviously it does take me a bit of effort to understand all this. Although I sympathize, but it's different. Sympathizing and talking about your own aunts and uncles is completely different. But do we need to keep remembering this? I mean, doesn't this create an ongoing and a persistent feeling of potentially of hatred, of anger that may block people from progressing in their lives as a nation?
I don't think Israelis are full of hatred. Israel have a wonderful relationship with Germany. and with many other countries. Who, mm-hmm. I mean, you think of Holland, for example. Most of the Jewish, Dutch Jewish, were expelled and were murdered during the war. No Israeli will tell you that we hate Holland. No. We say we have to learn and to remember because to learn the lessons. Mm-hmm. And the lesson is that things could happen under our nose, you know. And we should be aware that this
could repeat itself.
And this could, you know, we should be very, very aware. So, I mean,
that's,
and now,
that's the bit about, you know, but on the other hand, if we had to talk about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict,
right.
I would say that potentially most people in Malta perceive, have a sympathy towards the Palestinian cause, seem to understand very clearly the issues there, but do not understand very much certain things that Israel does. I mean,
and here I come to speak about Israel, because it's very, it's a different, you know, part of history. Mm-hmm. And as I said, clearly there were two populations in Israel. When the British left, there was the Arab population and the Jewish population. The best solution at the time still remains the best solution. A partition of that country to two. A Jewish state. An Arab state. Today we call it the Palestinian state. 60 years ago, nobody talked about the Palestinian state. It was called an Arab state, which is fine. And
so, what's the problem with that?
All right. So, we speak about 47, and as I said, there was a complete denial of the Arab world of that solution. It was rejected. Mm. As simple as that, rejected. And the idea was at the time that the seven Arab nations could defeat the Jewish population and finish with that problem. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen. And since then, we are in a constant struggle to arrive to that recognition. We Israelis now speak, of course, from an Israeli perspective.
Sure, fair enough.
To arrive to that recognition that the other countries that as well were created as a result of colonialism, right? The British have left, the French have left, and if you look at the borders in the Middle East, straight borders, right?
Boxes.
Between France and Great Britain, it was divided. There was no Jordan 150 years ago, no Syria, no Iraq in that respect. There were other, I mean, there were traditionally very, very old
civilizations
of course, that nobody will deny, on the contrary. This battle for recognition mm-hmm. is still maybe defining our politics today. It's a battle for recognition as a legitimate state in that region, as Egypt, as Jordan, as Lebanon, as a future Palestinian state, as Syria. And the Palestinian movement that was born in the late 50s and beginning mm-hmm. of the 60s fought for many years as well for the destruction of Israel. Mm-hmm. They fought to have a Palestinian state not alongside Israel, but instead of Israel. The major breakthrough was in the beginning of the 90s, the signing of the Oslo Accord. That was the whole point. We give up land, the Palestinians give us their recognition of our right to exist as a national state, Jewish state, in that region.
But why do you need their recognition?
That's an interesting question, because as long as there was no recognition, the Arab world launched, and not one time, a war for the destruction of Israel. Even today, if you'll hear the Iranian public statement, if you'll hear Hamas public statement, if you listen to Hezbollah public statement, there is no life alongside Israel. They call for the destruction of Israel. The Iranian president have talked about deleting Israel from the map. So, unfortunately, as you said, ironically, ridiculously, we still have to fight, and here, you know, and not literally, I mean, for as well. Recognition,
as well
literally, of our right to exist as a Jewish state in that region. Mm-hmm. Now,
Sorry, no. I was going to ask something, but I hope I don't derail you from your argument. But basically, the sort of little clarification that I would like to explore with you is whether this argument of the Arab nations not wanting Israel, or some of them, or a couple of them, talk about this, how would you talk about the fact that you are saying that let us have two states, but on the other hand, with all the roadblocks and stuff, it creates the impossibility of people going to work. It creates a system where people are not only on poverty, on the poverty line, but people without light. We had this a couple of months or years ago, where people weren't even having an access to petrol and whatever. So, you know, I start getting confused, because it becomes all very circular. I mean, it's like the way children act, in a way. No, I hit you, you hit me, I hit you, you hit me. But I mean, when does it stop? Because people in Palestine, you have the Hamas, which were democratically elected. That doesn't justify what they say and what they may do and do. But they have been...
Well, Hitler was as well democratically elected, as you know. I don't want to compare Hamas to Hitler, just to say that this phenomenon had happened in the past. So the election itself does not mean that the democratic system continues. So
yeah, but it's legitimate.
But I want to talk about Hamas in a moment. It's
a valid
question. But I have to go back a bit to history, and here I'm going back to 18 years ago. The Oslo process had the notion was that we work slowly about the different problems that we have, the different issues that we have to solve, which are clearly borders, in order to divide the land into countries, was a question of Jerusalem, that we claim as our internal capital, and the Palestinian would like as their capital for their future state. The question of refugees, because no doubt about it, in the wars between Israel and the Arab world, some Palestinians have fled and now live in refugee camps or in other countries or in other cities.
Few. Quite a number of thousands, no?
No. Few, I didn't mean that to minimize it. No. We're talking about hundreds of thousands. Of course, Jews have fled.
That's true.
My family, I mean, we lost all our property in Europe. Nothing. We started as farmers. My grandparent, who was an architect, built roads in Israel. I have no property whatsoever. And, you know, I never claimed my house in Warsaw, for that matter. Many Jews had to leave, were expelled from Arab states in 48. And here I'm talking about hundreds of thousands as well, half a million more or less, from Morocco, from Algeria, from Tunisia, from Libya, from Egypt, from Iraq, from Syria, left all their belongings, their shops, their property, and arrived in Israel with a bag, with a suitcase of clothes. So as well, when we talk about refugees, we have to remember that there were refugees on both sides. Okay. On both sides. This is, and I'll go back to refugees. But 91, Oslo, the Oslo Accord was all about that. We have to solve the issues that are outstanding. And this is borders, Jerusalem, refugees, removal of settlements, Jewish settlements in the West Bank. This process went on and was sabotaged in a few moments, a few critical moments. One of the critical moments were after our Prime Minister Rabin was assassinated by extreme right Jew who thought in that way will stop this peace process. Rabin was assassinated, and Shimon Peres, who is today our president, was his successor in the Labour Party, and there were elections coming on. And Peres was, of course, on the lead. I mean, there was no question that he will be elected. 3 months before the election, Hamas has blown up 4 buses in Israel, 2 in Tel Aviv, 1 in Jerusalem, and 1 in Ramat Gan. 80 people were killed. Now, you'll think of 80 people in a small country like Israel. The proportions is like thousands of people in the United States, proportionally to the population.
And so this is not about numbers.
And
it's about people.
Peres have lost the election because the sense in the Israeli public was that Palestinians are not really ready to live with us.
So it went back.
We went back years ago. There was another round of talks in 2000 where Prime Minister Barak at the time, Ehud Barak, today our Minister of Defense, was elected in the election of 1999 for peace. The Israeli public have said after a few years that Oslo was dying, let's say, we want peace, we want the Labour Party, we want them to achieve peace, real peace. And after a year in office, he arrived in Camp David with Arafat to sign a peace treaty. And we are talking about the same issues, borders, Jerusalem, settlements, refugees, the main issues. And there was a plan. That is, you know, now there's the debate whether we offer 94% and compensation of territory in, you know, to compensate for this 6% of land, or 97%. But we were talking about dividing the land, withdrawing from the West Bank and from the Gaza Strip, and building a new Palestinian state. That was the offer in Camp David. Arafat came to Camp David and just could not sign this deal for different reasons. And here you can hear many speculation. Why couldn't he? Did he have the backing of the Arab states, of the Arab leaders? Did he not? Did he personally just couldn't do it, couldn't make this transformation from being a leader of a national movement, terrorist movement, depends who will define it, to become a statesman, a leader of a small country that have to take care of the sewage of the education of health system and not the heroic battles for independence? Could he personally make this said? Or he thought that he will launch another wave of terrorism and maybe will get a bit of a better deal. Maybe that was his calculation. The summit was failed, and September 2000, a new wave of terrorism, the second intifada, was launched, where over a thousand Israelis lost their life. And if I'm not mistaken, more than 3,000 Palestinians lost their life in a Israeli reprisal for terrorist attacks. And here we go back to this cycle. The plan, the idea is there. The ingredients is a full Palestinian acknowledgement of the right of Israel to exist, a Palestinian readiness to live in peace with Israel. And here we're talking about the whole Palestinian people. And unfortunately, within the Palestinian people, you still have groups like Hamas, who are very strong, who are having the backing of Iran, and who refuse.
What do they want? Just the annihilation of Israel? The Hamas?
Yeah, to have the Palestinian state instead of Israel. And to have a religious state. I mean, there are other components. Hamas is not only a nationalist organization. Hamas is a fundamentalist, religious, a terroristic movement.
We've almost run out of time, unfortunately. So the next time you're in Malta, I think I'll call you again. But I have two little questions, which I appreciate that they are very complex issues, but I would like a very abridged answer, possibly. The first question that I would like to ask is, what is the Jerusalem debate? I mean, are we talking about splitting up Jerusalem, or are we talking about Israel claiming that Jerusalem has to remain part of of its territory? Because I think that's
well, as we always said, and that will be discussed mm-hmm. between the parties. I mean, there is no solution to the question of Jerusalem yet. Jerusalem is had an old city, the old city of Jerusalem, within the walls, where the most holy sites for all religions are, the historic place where the Jewish temple have stood, the a Muslim mosque, and of course the church. The question, and there are the Hebrew or the Jewish part of Jerusalem, which is West Jerusalem, and the Arab part of Israel, of Jerusalem, which is East Jerusalem. The main issue is the old city. What will be happening to the old city? How we can reach an agreement that will promise all faiths freedom of access to the religious sites, and how we can manage this very small, or I mean, you'll think of Valletta, more or less. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. And this is the question of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was always the capital of Jewish states throughout history. Palestinians claim Jerusalem as their future capital. And agreement should have to be discussed between the parties. I am an optimistic. I think everything could be resolved when it's come to concrete issues, and not to hate and not to religion, but to issues on the ground that we can solve in conversations.
And the last very quick one, I'm coming from a background where I work and I research this youth in particular. With all this going around and happening in Israel, do young people in Israel look forward to family, to creating, to developing careers?
Absolutely. I mean,
do they have that energy that
absolutely
that still manage
and
that?
As you said, you'll have to come to Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv
I
is
will,
the most
will,
vibrant city, and Israelis have this urge for innovation, for families. I mean, Israelis still have big families, clearly, relatively to Europeans. The sense of family is still very, very strong in our holidays, in our tradition. If you look at Israeli economy, you look at all that innovations, I mean, all that startups in Israel, high technology, research, and it's all come from this energy to be always on the cutting edge, to be always in the lead. We don't have petrol, we don't have gas, we don't have any natural resources, we have our minds, and with that we have to make a living. And that gives energy, and whomever arrives to Israel, I think that makes a big impact. I mean, how lively or energetic the city are, and this is of course based on young people. I mean, mainly on young people.
Right. Well, it has been a pleasure, Ms. Rachel Feinmesser. Thank you for this interesting interview. I would like to thank the people who have been listening to this program and wish all the very best, and remind you that next week we'll be here again with another intriguing debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.